You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where blackface is the name for the sequel to Black Panther. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, and when you are listening to this episode, I am either incredibly exuberant or incredibly depressed because we are recording this before the Super Bowl on Super Bowl Sunday. It would be weird to record on like Super Bowl Sunday or Monday, which doesn't exist. So, unfortunately, Daniel is currently in Orlando on a business trip. So, joining me this trip from right next to me in Midside Central, Midside Headquarters, William Green.
Hello, hello. Thanks for having me over on Super Bowl Sunday, where I get to watch your exuberance or depression live.
Yeah, if anyone watched the Belichick Your Premises live stream for the championship games, they will have seen William's awkward reaction to me when the Patriots clinched their appearance in the Super Bowl. Now you get to see that live, William.
That's awesome.
Are you afraid or are you excited?
I am excited. I'm very excited. I think this is going to be great fun. If not, I'll just go out and stand out on the balcony out here and let you scream into the wind or whatever you need to do.
Well, it is the first floor, so there is no balcony. So don't worry, everyone. I won't be jumping off if we lose. So don't worry. It is a patio. This year feels a little different. I think we talked about it on Belichick Your Premises last week at the beginning of that segment. It feels a lot different from last year, so I have high hopes for this game. But this is not a football podcast. This is apparently a blackface podcast. So let's get into it in the news without Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
So this segment brought to you by our Patreon supporters at themidside.com/Patreon or patreon.com/themidside. You too can support our wonderful show and keep the lights on for a small donation every time we post awesome content or just good content. Mostly awesome content.
Adequate content.
we'll take a small donation from your account and you will help keep the lights on. So our first story, as teased at the beginning of the show, Ralph Northam, med school yearbook page, shows blackface KKK photo. A page dedicated to Virginia Governor Ralph Northam and his medical school yearbook shows two men, one of whom is presumably Northam, posing in blackface in a Ku Klux Klan uniform. The photo, the existence of which was first reported by the conservative news website Big League Politics, has since been verified by National Review. Appears on Northam's page in the Eastern Virginia Medical School's Class of 1984 yearbook. The page also features three other photos of Northam accompanied by the quotation, "There are more old drunks than there are doctors." So I'm going to skip down because I love the reaction from folks. So the Virginia State Senate Minority Leader Richard Saslow, a Democrat from Fairfax, defended Northam in comments in the Washington Post. His whole life has been about executing the opposite, and that's what you need to examine, not something that occurred 30 years ago, he said. While it's in very poor taste, I would think there is a problem. No one in the General Assembly who would like their college conduct examined. So, Justin, would you like your college conduct examined by the National Review and the Fairfax representative?
I welcome the Spanish Inquisition. I'm a strange case, though. I've never been one of these people who believed what these people are saying, and it's one of the things I hate the most about our culture. This idea that college is 4 years outside of reality, that you can do whatever you want. And people do things that they know are immoral and they know are wrong because they think they can get away with it because they're in this insulated community. And I'm just different. I mean, if you're going to examine my college life, it was in undergrad. I just sat in the community center and watched everyone walk by between classes. I ate dinner and lunch by myself. And in grad school, I just cared about football. So you're not going to get much if you examine me. But that's the difference here is we're starting to see the effects of this destructive culture we had, that this idea that you can be self-destructive, that you can act in these immoral ways, and it's excused because you're youthful. You know, there's a level of, yeah, you're going to make mistakes as a youth. But on the other hand, when you know you're going to make mistakes and you use that as mistakes to as an excuse to make mistakes that you know are wrong going in, it's not really a mistake at that point. And then the other problem with this story is the double standard we see here. Right? Remember how Brett Kavanaugh was raked over the coals for what was in his yearbook?
Mm-hmm.
Brett Kavanaugh was raked over the coals. He gave that speech that we gave an award to, right? We gave the Tom Brady greatness, a medal for greatness in the face of doubters award to Brett Kavanaugh for that opening statement he gave in his Spanish Inquisition. Now, what does this guy do? All he does is offer an apology. I'm sorry. I know it was wrong then, and I know it's wrong now, and I'm sorry. And that's it? And we just sweep it under the rug? Am I perceiving this wrong?
Well, I want to push back against that. Sweep it under the rug? Like, what is the statute of limitations on these things? Like, I may have made an offensive joke in college. I don't remember right now. But when someone – if someone were to find some, like, you know, 8-track recording of me making a bad joke in college and recorded it today, all of a sudden – It's like the person today that exists right here sitting next to you did it.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? Like, there's a complete disconnect of the context, right? It's like, wait a minute. Like, you know, that for me, that was, you know, 20 years ago and not the person I am today.
Right. It's like when Eminem started out and somebody tried to find early recordings of him in someone's basement saying the N-word. And they tried to be like, oh, look, we can't let him be a famous rapper now because he did this when he was up and coming in someone's basement. He was probably in high school at that point, too. So, yeah, I know. I agree completely with what you're saying. I'm talking about the people who are doing the Inquisition. I'm talking about their double standard.
Yeah.
I'm not saying ours. I don't care about this. I don't care. Whatever. He did this in the past. Whatever. It's done. It's over. Kavanaugh had the stuff he wrote. Whatever. It's done. It's over. I personally don't care. But I'm talking about the people doing the Inquisition. If Brett Kavanaugh's speech was not enough, where he cried and threw himself upon their mercy, and this guy is essentially Facebook post, and I'm saying it literally was, but this is the equivalent of an apology on Facebook, is enough? Is that not a double standard? Especially because this guy is a Democrat, is he not?
Yes.
So do you see what I'm saying about the double standard?
Yeah, definitely. But I think I just want to hammer that point home about the context here just being completely dropped, right? Like this outrage culture is using the fact that when someone uncovers something like this, that they place it in today's context and they also make it feel like it just happened. Like this guy just did that, right?
Yeah.
And that's the part that bothers me. That's not to defend anything anyone's done 30 years ago, right? There's certainly things that are indefensible, but we can't deny the reality that that the past was a thing that actually happened a long time ago, and people had different ideas and different understandings, and they all had their own different context back then.
Yeah.
Again, not to defend anything that this person did. I think to me this makes sense. Like a Democrat in the 80s being racist, of course that makes sense, especially in the South. Like, do we all like forget history or something?
Yeah, Robert Byrd.
Yeah.
Right?
Do we just forget history? Like this is not surprising. Like this isn't revelatory at all.
But the point is, he shouldn't have to apologize. Agree. And if he has to apologize, we need to have the same standard for no matter who it is. You can't pick and choose what the standard is based upon what side
you're on. We have
the
same standard for everyone. It says, if Democrat, then Facebook post. If Republican, then end your life. That's what I mean. That's the same standard for everyone. It's a giant if statement. The same standard, same program is executed every time.
Well, when you're talking about, sorry, if anyone could hear that in the background,
the podcat is going crazy.
The podcat has decided to attack the couch, which is bad. So I'm trying to manage having this very intellectual commentary at the same time I'm trying to stop the cat from destroying my apartment. She doesn't like that the attention's not on her. Anyway, when you're talking about William, the dropping of context, I think that leads perfectly into the second story, doesn't it?
I think it does too. Our second story. from Phoenix. A Phoenix restaurant says, this is a photo of coal miners, but I see offensive blackface.
Not you, the writer of the article, correct?
Yes, the writer, that's the headline. The sub is, opinion, who determines what's offensive? A photo in a downtown Phoenix restaurant raises this key question.
And the author is a guy by the name of Rashad Thomas.
So, we'll post a link of this, of course, to themidside.com/podcast. You can see all the news stories. We link them all the time. But this picture is literally a famous picture of coal miners after work. This is very common picture.
Oh, is this a famous picture? I thought this was just every picture of coal miners after
work.
Yeah,
it's just, they just use the same. This is like the stock photo.
Oh, okay.
So they're covered in soot, okay? And they're obviously quite dirty. And there's a lady sitting in the one side, she is not black, and nor is she covered in soot. So I'm not going to presume her race, but she might be transracial. I don't know.
You already assumed her gender.
Well, that's true. I did do that. I guess it's my gay privilege. So let's get into the story. A few weeks ago...
That's because the women weren't allowed to work in the mines back then.
Yeah.
They weren't given the privilege of risking their lives in case a mine collapsed. All right, I just went to MRA, sorry.
So this is every time you hear I, this is opinion piece, so this is not my opinion. A few weeks ago, I attended a holiday party at a downtown Phoenix restaurant. I walked around to view the photographs on the wall. Then a photograph caught my attention. Friend said...
Can I stop you for a second there? Can I translate that?
I was looking to get offended,
yes,
so
exactly.
I was staring at some pictures.
I walked around the restaurant looking for something that I could get offended at.
So continuing the article, friend said, it's coal miners at a pub after work.
Translation, friend said, shut the fuck up and enjoy your time in this restaurant because someone invited you to a holiday party and stop causing trouble. You know what's coming.
It was a photograph of coal miners with blackened faces. I asked a Latinx, I just threw up my mouth a little bit, and white woman for their opinion. They said,
translation, I ignored all the white people because they don't matter.
They said it looked like coal miners at a pub after work. Then they stepped back, frowned, and said, it's men in blackface. So anyways, this person, you know, demanded to talk to the manager, all this other stuff. Like, this article is interesting to me for one particular reason. But Justin, why is it interesting to you?
Because I can't wait for the next sequel to Men in Black. We're going to be talking about Men in Black International on today's Trailer Takedown, but I can't wait for Men in Black Face. That is going to be the best sequel to Men in Black ever. No, this is interesting because he even says it. He uses the context word in the article. The complete dropping of context to be offended is so interesting. This is so revealing to me.
This is why it's interesting to me. I have to jump in because as a writer, you understand this when I say this. He hung a lantern on his context dropping.
Yeah.
That's all this article is. It's just, I'm hanging a lantern on this context topic, but then I'm just going to do it anyway.
But that's what social justice is. This is the point they have to get at in 2019, right? I think that 2018 was probably peak social justice, right? We always talk about peak farce.
One can only hope.
That's the hope. And that's what I think, because now they have to write articles like this, because they know people are going to look at it and go, oh, wow, you're just looking to get offended by dropping context. So the only way you can get around that is you're 100% correct. To hang a lantern on it. And that's why it's so interesting, because now you have to actually look at it and say, does he really believe this? Or is he just doing this for an agenda or for attention?
I want to know, though, why... So we already know, because of the intersectional, like, sort of algebra, the calculus you have to go into, mm-hmm. like, we have to forget, like, who these coal miners are, right? Aren't coal miners usually poor? Usually a minority, right? Either Irish or
Wait. The Irish can't be minorities. They're white.
They were at this time.
All white
right?
people are the
yeah,
same.
Yeah, again, we're dropping the context, right? Like, we're talking about very poor, very, usually immigrants. Like, immigrants. These are immigrants, more than likely, right?
Right.
I mean, again, I'm not trying to buy into the social justice argument. I kind of go with that, the Adam Carolla method of, like, if I don't know anything about this, and I don't know anything about these people, then I can draw certain, you know, trends. I could say they're probably a minority. They're probably poor.
Well, you know,
I can draw
poor
these...
because the rich people don't want to go into the mines that could collapse.
Yeah, exactly. I can
like,
draw
if I can pay money, where am I going to fucking put my life at risk?
Yeah. Now, as soon as I know a single true fact about one of these individuals, then I throw all those
right.
Notions out
right.
the window, right? So, but
what
just
you're
looking
even
at
talking
this,
about is he's drop. Just looking at that, he's dropping the context of what was going on in American history at the time.
Can we? I'm going to do a false dichotomy here. Using that logic I just used, if I looked at this and said, "Are any of the people in this picture racist?" I'd have to say probably because of the historical time period, right? Probably.
Well, does that mean any time period? I mean, probably.
Exactly.
People
exactly.
In any time period.
You're getting to the heart of the false dichotomy there, right? Like, but they draw the conclusion, well, because these people are racist and they have black stuff on their face, therefore it's blackface, right? Like they, or even worse, they're saying when we look at a piece of art, they're saying that all that matters is our subjective interpretation. I
yes.
think that's really the meta here. Because
yes.
I think that's what makes this article interesting, more than just the hanging a lantern and the context dropping. That's an important new trend, like you pointed out. But I think also this is a sort of out in the open, blatant argument for subjectivism in art, which obviously you and I are not in favor of, right?
Well, I wouldn't even call this art at this point. I mean, we can argue whether just putting a photograph of coal miners on the wall, it's a group photo. There's nothing like artistic about it. It looks like they just captured a group photo. So to me, this is even relativism, subjectivism in reality. They're just how you look at the world. And that's how the hanging the lantern is scary, because now all you have to do is say, yeah, of course I'm being subjective, and then it's okay to be subjective. It's just conceding the premise. You're conceding the base premise of subjectivism by hanging a lantern.
So this is interesting. Can any I don't want to get into whether this picture is art. I would say it's framed and it's hung in a restaurant for a certain ambiance. So it's sort of decorative art at the very least, right?
Yes.
But even that being said, isn't this like you said, this is a photograph. It's not very posed. It's you know, more naturalistic, which isn't a terrible thing with when it comes to photography, right? Especially for something decorative. But if this is naturalism, what are they supposed to do about it? Right? Like how are you, does that mean we should strike from the record, the historical record, all photos of people that are coal miners? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like what are we supposed to do?
Well, it's ironic because the quickest way to repeat history is to forget it. So,
but it's offensive.
I understand that, but that's what I'm saying, is they're actually working against their own purpose. If we take down all these statues, if we take down all these pictures, eventually people will forget that it ever happened, and then it'll just repeat itself. So they're actually shooting themselves in the foot without realizing they're shooting themselves in the foot. They're trying to have this power play to create this utopia. But you can't create a utopia by erasing the past. It doesn't work that way.
I think we should start, just like in Babylon 5, we should start the Ministry of Truth and have a bunch of people, probably a trans activist, which we'll get into later, probably a trans activist, to just tell us to look at something and just shout their feelings about what part is offensive, and then we'll just take a giant eraser and erase those things. And that's then when we're left with nothing at the end, then we'll know. We know social justice has succeeded. It has wiped the record of all things.
We can
all
only do Battlestar Galactica if I can be the Balzar.
I said Babylon 5, but that's
Babylon 5. Fuck, my joke's gone.
Exactly, gone. Dana's not even here, and I'm shitting on your joke.
That's all right.
All right.
I've never seen Babylon 5, to be honest. That's why it translated to Battlestar Galactica.
Oh man!
But I couldn't remember the Ministry of Truth, so I was just like, I'm gonna make an Asian joke, but forget it.
Too late. So the big game is on later in just a few hours as we're recording this. No one's buying the NFL's reason for canceling Maroon 5's pre-Super Bowl press conference. Maroon 5 is still scheduled to perform the Super Bowl halftime show despite a growing flurry of discussion about the group's decision to participate given the league's treatment of Colin Kaepernick. But getting the group to talk about the performance before they're on stage on Sunday doesn't seem likely. The NFL abruptly canceled the band's pre-Super Bowl press conference on Tuesday night. With media already in Atlanta to cover the New England Patriots and the Los Angeles Rams' own media day on Monday, anybody hoping to ask Adam Levin a question about systemic police brutality against people of color will be out of luck. So, Justin, are you dying to know what Adam Levin's views on police brutality is?
I'm dying to know who Adam Levin is. His name is Adam Levine. Adam Levine. This is insane. It's insane because we've decided, what, Atlanta is a black city or something? So a black artist has to perform in the Atlanta Super Bowl? I don't understand, because never in the history of a Super Bowl have they picked a performer from that city, have they? Has that been a thing?
Yeah, I remember when they opened Ford Field and they had the Super Bowl there. I think they push out Aretha Franklin in her cart.
My point is, every year it's not like they go, okay, now the Super Bowl's in Minnesota, we need to have someone from Minneapolis. I mean, Prince didn't even perform then, right? I mean, he was dead, but he performed at a
he could perform for the grave.
he was at a former Super Bowl, right? He wasn't at that one, so it's not like they link it to that city. And then somehow, Colin Kaepernick kneeling has something to do with who performs at halftime. And then, even more to the point, that has some effect on the questions that this white guy has to answer at a press conference. None of this makes any sense.
Yeah, why does Adam Levine have to, like, atone for our sins? Is he Jesus or something?
Because the NFL picked him, he has to say something? Like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, he was picked to perform music. Look, they can say they don't buy the NFL's excuse, but this is a way that I hope we start backing into what's rational in our culture. The NFL's quote-unquote excuse was the musical artist will let their performance speak for itself. Isn't that what a musical artist should do? Why should we be having a press conference for the Super Bowl halftime performer every year anyway? Look, when it's Justin Timberlake, fine. He's also an entertainer. He's also a comedian. He's a very funny guy. After music, he made a career as a comedic actor and as a dramatic actor, but he's most known for comedy. So fine, give him a press conference. He's going to be entertaining. But Adam Levine, Maroon 5, why do they need a press conference? Yeah, let their music speak for themselves. This whole thing is just insane to me. Is it insane to you?
I think I'm looking forward to the halftime show where the social justice posturing should be off the charts. I think it's going to be... it's going to be all the talk. Well, maybe not in the show itself, but I'll be following the... no matter what they do, people are going to be offended. They're going to be triggered on Twitter.
So. I will not be changing the channel because I'm going to have other people here, but WWE is doing a six-man tag match with six of the up-and-coming stars in professional wrestling, and to me, that's much more appealing because none of that social justice stuff is going to be there. You're just going to see these guys putting on a good match, and it's going to be entertaining. That is what I would rather watch, but I'll probably just, hopefully I won't be depressed like I was during the Falcons Super Bowl, the comeback Super Bowl, and hopefully I'll be excited about what's going on going forward.
So our next story, major DNA testing company sharing genetic data with the FBI. The decision by a prominent consumer DNA testing company to share data with federal law enforcement means investigators have access to genetic information linked to hundreds of millions of people. Family Tree DNA, an early pioneer of the rapidly growing market for consumer genetic testing, confirmed late Thursday that it has granted access to the Federal Bureau of Investigation to its vast treasure trove of nearly 2 million genetic profiles. The arrangement was first reported by BuzzFeed News, who fired all of their staff. Sorry, that was just my editorial. It's been bad right now in the news industry.
For BuzzFeed News, which is collapsing in on itself.
Concerns about unfettered access to genetic information gathered by testing companies have swelled since April, when police used a genealogy website to ensnare a suspect in the decades-old case of the Golden State Killer. But that site, GEDmatch, was open source, meaning police were able to upload crime scene DNA data to the site without permission. The latest arrangement marks the first time a commercial testing company has voluntarily given law enforcement access to their data. The move is of concern to more than just privacy-minded Family Tree DNA customers. One person sharing genetic information also exposes those to whom they are closely related. That's how police caught the alleged Golden State Killer. A study last year estimated only 2% of the population needs to have done DNA tests for virtually everyone's genetic information to be represented in that data. So, Justin, are you ready for our new DNA overlords at the FBI?
I don't think they're competent enough to become our DNA overlords. I mean, this is how incompetent the government is. They had to use an open source... That we can hear that, right? I'm sure that's on the recording right now. I'm sure that's on the recording. Come on! I feel like Bill Burr right now. I feel like I'm going to start turning around and yelling at Naya. Have you ever listened to Bill Burr's podcast?
No.
Oh. No, they're so incompetent at their job that they had to use an open source DNA site in order to catch the Golden State Killer.
That's evidence of incompetence. That's creative thinking. Why is that incompetence?
Because as someone who works at a government job, you have to use private resources to get the government job done because they can't do their job. Trust me. That's what that is.
No. I think that's creative. That was a creative investigation technique.
I agree it's creative. I'm just saying they should be able to develop their own tools. Regardless of that.
Wait, we want the FBI developing a DNA database? I don't think so.
That's an interesting discussion. That's what they say later on in the article, yeah. Right? And that's an interesting discussion. The thing here is this is... every time one of us is missing, articles that are really important for that person who's missing to talk about pop up in the news. I really wish we had Daniel this week, because this is an example of the third-party doctrine. And he could talk about it a lot better than I could. But the idea is, if you give your information to a third party, then you have no reasonable expectation of privacy anymore. So these people have given their DNA to these sites, these genealogy sites, or now they have ones where, like, you know, 23andMe or color.com, how do you get away with calling something color.com right now and you're testing
in today's
someone's
climate? Yeah.
I don't understand that. They give it to them, and then they have a reasonable expectation of privacy, they think, but they don't. According to the law, according to the courts, the third party doctrine, they don't have that. So it's scary, but. Here's the other hand from the consumer's perspective. It is a value to me to be able to give my genetic testing over, to give my genes over, and get a genetic test back that says what I'm predisposed to medically. That way I can get better treatment from, you know, the doctors. If I have kids, they can know what they're predisposed to. But then I put myself at risk. But then on the other hand, it's what Adam Kroll always says. Go ahead, monitor me. Go ahead. I'm not doing anything illegal. So where is the line between privacy and getting value in a private transaction? Does this reveal that the third-party doctrine is actually bad? Immoral?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it's, you know, we try to, through legislation, keep people's medical data private. And I think there's a legitimate reason for that, right? And I think that technology, as we go forward, is going to continue to figure out ways to keep data private but still allow for the aggregation of data for research purposes and stuff like that. I think that's really important. But yeah, some of these DNA sites, like cooperating with authorities, seems really scary in an important way. I mean, I'm glad if people are consenting to share this for this reason, then I'm all for it. But I think the important part there is the consent, right? And then also worrying about, you know, something as there's a sense in which, not to get all disgusting on you, but you're leaving your DNA all over the place everywhere you go, right? like your skin cells are falling off, you know?
Right. Well, that's the argument about the third party doctrine, right?
Yeah.
The argument is, in reality, when you go to a place, you have no reasonable expectation of privacy. So why then, if you go to a place digitally, do you think you have a reasonable expectation of privacy? If you go to a store and they see what you're browsing at, they can record you and they can use that to create a profile on you.
Mm-hmm.
Why then, when you go to Amazon and you're searching for certain things, should you have an expectation that profile that they've created would be private? That's the argument for, in favor of, the third party doctrine.
Yeah. Yep. Well, I have one more story. I know we don't have we're one section short today, so I'm going to bring up this one other story. This is from Quillette, which I highly recommend for people.
I'm not prepped for this guy. So I say something offensive, then
so,
I'm right on track.
But I had to bring this one up. So the article is Homophobia in the Modern Trans Movement. This is written by Sky Gilbert at Quillette. So 2.5 years ago, I spoke in Vancouver at a queer-to-queer symposium on queer theater performance. After I delivered my paper, I became a focal point for criticism, though not because of the content of my presentation. The controversy emerged in the Q&A when I mentioned the fact that I was not only a gay man, but also a drag queen. Members of the audience stood up and opined about the apparently problematic practice of white drag queens, like him, lip-syncing to appropriated music, by which they meant music written originally by performers that are non-white. So, it is undeniably true that drag queens of all races have a special affection for works of divas of color and pay homage to those idols by lip-syncing. It is also true that gay and drag entertainment culture is centered in a large part around pop music more generally. There is an industry that owes much to musicians of color, which also have had their use worked or co-opted without adequate compensation.
What the hell is this article?
But while this was a fair point for debate, the discussion quickly spiraled off into an entirely different direction. When I tried to defend drag queens from the podium, saying that camp culture was an important part of our heritage, a trans member of the audience, a person who asked to be identified as they, made a statement that sticks in my mind. So this is the trans person saying this.
Wait. So a trans person is saying this to a drag queen,
yes,
who is gay but identifies as his own gender, but appropriating minority culture.
Yep.
When
we're about to go
queen.
All the way down the rabbit hole. You ready for this one?
No.
This is why I brought this one. I'm ready for your head explode.
There's no way I could ever possibly be ready for whatever's going to come.
Oh,
next.
You're ready for this. Remember that the people who died at Pulse nightclub were listening to appropriated music. They told the room. The speaker was referring to, of course, the massacre of 49 innocents at a gay dance club in Orlando, Florida, a tragedy that was still fresh in everyone's mind. The victims were queer and queer allies. It stands as one of the deadliest mass shootings in U.S. history. I asked them, do you mean to say we shouldn't mourn the queers who were murdered at Pulse nightclub because they were listening to appropriated music? There was no clear response, silence and a shrug. No one in the room said anything about this completely shocking display.
Wait, I don't understand. Was the speaker, the drag queen, offended or not offended at that comment? Because
She was offended.
Okay. Yeah,
by that comment.
I was going to say, because that comment's fairly reasonable. That comment is a fairly good reductio ad absurdum of their argument about appropriation.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, that's pretty good. I wasn't expecting it to be that good. So they're offended. So now they critiqued him. They critiqued the drag queen, right, for using appropriated music. And then this person used an argument to support the drag queen, but the drag queen's offended by the argument that supports
him. No,
the
trans person was taking, she honestly took the opinion that we should not, that remember the Pulse nightclub people were doing appropriate music, we should not mourn them.
Okay, right? that argument was so retarded that my brain
automatically went to
the opposite.
No, it is as evil as your brain is rejecting right now. That's why I brought that article.
My brain is literally rejecting that. You need to read that quote again because I literally heard the opposite.
So remember that the people who died at Pulse nightclub were listening to appropriated music, they told the room. I asked them, do you mean to say we shouldn't mourn the queers who were murdered at Pulse nightclub because they were listening to appropriated music?
So the speaker asked them.
Yeah.
Okay, that's where I got
there was no clear response, silence and a shrug. No one in the room said anything about this completely shocking display. So the point of this article is that right now, and this is something we've kind of known from a pattern from 2018, if you are trans, you are the pinnacle of intersectional politics right now. You can literally say anything and not be offensive. If any other person said that we shouldn't mourn the people of the Pulse nightclub for any reason, right? Any other reason, right? They would immediately be shocked and offensive, right? But apparently, if you are trans, you can say we should not mourn the death of innocent people at the Pulse nightclub because they were listening to appropriated music.
That's because the bigger the victim you are, the less moral responsibility you have, according to social justice.
Yeah, the article goes on, and it's actually pretty good, and I would encourage everyone to click through the link on our website and check out Quillette.com and see this article in particular. It's pretty disturbing to me, especially since, you know, for all of us, the Pulse nightclub thing is pretty close to home for all of us here. So,
yeah, Midsider Elliot, we love you, man. All right, so that's a disturbing end to the news segment. Let's talk about things that are a little more exciting in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events. In the air timeline lapse, my made-for-TV type was written. Midsiders out there, if you are not yet on our Discord channel, please get on our Discord channel and join the conversation. We actually got one of the trailers this week from the Discord channel. We've gotten many trailers in the past from the Discord channel. You guys have given us great articles, great commentary. We enjoy interacting with you like that. So get on the Discord channel. You can do it by going to any episode. We have a link on any episode on themidside.com/podcast. For the review this week, I want to go a little different away from movies, mainly because there hasn't been anything interesting out yet. They're going to be pacing things, interestingly, February through May. If you go and you look at the release schedule for the major movies, there's going to be a bunch of stuff coming out. I don't know if I'm going to see all of them, because a lot of them are like Marvel movies. You know, like Captain Marvel looks terrible, so I probably won't see it. I don't even know if I'm going to see Shazam at this point. But until then, I have to find things to keep me occupied. And I want to talk about a video game right now, William, because I'm a big South Park fan. Everybody knows that. If you're a Midsider, you should know that by now. And the first South Park game, The Stick of Truth, was tremendous. It hit all the right notes as far as being able to walk around the town of South Park and interact with the storylines of the show. So then they made another game. But Trey Parker and Matt Stone, the creators of South Park, after making the first game, said, "We didn't really understand video games at that point, so the second game is going to be even better." So I got this second game, The Fractured Butthole, which is about superhero, the kids are pretending to be superheroes, so it's sending up the whole Marvel culture, the whole Marvel DC culture. But here's my problem with the game. Every time I sit down to play it, it's too complex for me. It used to be, back in the day, you would play these games where you would go into a shop, and you would buy the item, and then you would just gain the experience points, or you would gain the, you know, oh, this item will make you better at attacking people, or this item will make you better at defense. Then it became you bought the item, and you had to equip it, and you had to pick which character to equip it, and you could only equip certain things based on how many points you had. Now, you have to buy the item, find other items, craft the item, and then figure out how to equip it based on all the different characters' experience points. Then you have to decide who is in your party. Then when you fight, you have to decide where to move on the board, which character to attack, who to heal or not, and between battles, you have to decide where to go on the map to do which storyline, and the storylines are non-linear. You can do them in any order. For me, I have too much going on in my life, and this is too complex. My question is, who can play these games? Because it seems like you're just engaging in another life. It seems like you would have to live all day and then be like, okay, now I'm going to go into my second life. And of course, there was the non-story-based, non-goal-based game called Second Life, which probably was a reference to what I'm talking about. But to me, it seems like, do you have to have something wrong with you to engage in games that are this immersive? It seems like you would have to have some sort of personality disorder. You'd have to be evading reality. Or am I the crazy one?
I think you're the crazy one.
Okay, can you explain this to me as a video game guy?
Yeah.
I sit down to play these games, and I fucking, 5 minutes in, I go, I don't get fucking time for this. And then I just, like, I go back and I played, like, Bejeweled on my phone.
I think that the difference between The Stick of Truth and The Fractured Butthole is that they added a lot more like XCOM style elements and a little more light RPG elements. So they added parts to the game from genres that you would not be into, because it does take a certain amount of disciplined set aside time. So you're thinking of it as like, oh, you have nothing better to do. Whereas I would kind of reject that premise. Is if someone gets true enjoyment out of these things, they put the time into it. Because I could look at, right now you're wearing your Patriots hat, your Patriots jersey.
Uh-huh.
How much time have you spent reading articles this week on the upcoming game?
Not as much as you would think, because I don't need to hear what they're going to say, because Belichick, your premises, has better commentary than any of the analysts out there. Thank you for setting up that reference.
But do you get what I'm saying here, though, right?
I understand
I could look at from the outside and look at the time you invest in football and totally say, what, do you not have a life? Can't you use that time to go to the gym or do other things?
Ah, that's exactly what I was just going to say. You're trying to cut my argument off at the pass.
Yeah.
This is something that happened to me in grad school. So I bought the Grand Theft Auto collection in grad school. And my roommate at the time would play it. And in the game, the character would go to the gym and lift and get stronger. And he's sitting there having his character lift. And I'm just looking at him. I'm like, why aren't you going to the gym and lifting? If you're going to talk about disciplined time to set aside, why would I not use that for something that's going to improve myself?
I think you're absolutely right. And I think for some people, this is filling a hole. But for other people, it is a value they pursue. They get enjoyment out of it. I think today you have a much healthier relationship with football than you did in grad school, right? You were filling a social hole with football in grad school versus today, right? Where it's an integrated value in your life, right? Same thing can be done with video games, right? People can fall into that trap of using it to fill a hole in their life, but that's true of a lot of values, right? So I think if people really, the amount of time I put into, like, let's say, like, right now, Super Smash Brothers Ultimate is the game I'm playing a lot of. I'm playing 30, 40 minutes here and there, right? But if I want to, like, go to the tournament in June, man, do I have to change my engagement with that value, right? Like, if I really value, like, going to the Super Smash Brothers tournament, I'd have to change my interaction. I played three chapters of Red Dead Redemption 2. Really enjoyed it during the Christmas break. I haven't been able to pick it up again because I know I have to play it a little bit every day, and I have other games I would rather play, other things I'd like to do. I'm going to the climbing gym. Yeah, it fits in my hierarchy of values.
Right, and I think that's the problem I personally have. Like, you say you play 30, 40 minutes at a time. I would feel like if I'm playing the South Park game, there's the Fractured But Whole, that if I spent 30 to 40 minutes on it a day, that I'm not accomplishing anything. That I'm not giving the time, the game, the game, the
time. Do you feel the same when you watch a TV show or a movie for 30 or 40 minutes?
If it's longer than 30 or 40 minutes, yeah, I won't. Sometimes I won't watch shows. Like, it took me a long time to get through Mad Men because I needed to take the time to be able to give it a dedicated, however long the episode was, where I could actually pay attention to it. I needed to be in the proper mental state. I just don't feel like I could do anything in the game with 30 to 40 minute chunks. I would have to play like at least 3 hours at a time in order to get anything done to give it the proper care it needs.
I don't see a problem with that. I play League of Legends. The games are 40 minutes to an hour for one game. So I don't see a problem with investing that much in a value. I think that's the premise that you need to unpack more, is thinking about, like, if this is actually a value to someone, if they get it, they're getting spiritual fuel out of it. It changes the calculus, right? Like, it becomes like, how do I fit it into my busy schedule? Not like, oh, look at all the things I'm giving up because I'm doing this thing that I don't care about, right? If actually getting a value out of it, then it's worth the investment.
I guess it's because I want to care about it because it's very well made. I mean, have you played the Fractured But Whole?
I've played part of it. Yeah,
it's very well made. I mean,
it's not as good as Stick of Truth from like a story and plot perspective, but a lot of quality of life improvements. I liked the XCOM elements. I thought they were funny.
I mean, what the hell does XCOM mean?
XCOM is a game. It's a turn-based strategy game. You know the part where you're on the grid and how you move around the grid during the fight?
Yeah.
That's like very XCOM.
Okay.
That game genre sort of defines that genre.
Okay.
I like those elements. I think that was pretty cool. I like they all at one point they're so if you're gamers, there's the XCOM map is sort of like laid out on the street, and every once in a while there's like a car that comes and they're like, car, and they all like get up on the sidewalk and the car drives by.
Yeah, that was
like,
funny. Oh, that was funny.
It's lots of little things like that really make it worthwhile.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I like about the South Park games is that element of it. They also did something too that the game's easier for you. Or no, the game's easier for you if your character is white and harder for you.
The difficulty slider for the game is also your skin tone slider.
Yeah.
So the darker your skin, the more difficult the game.
Yeah, so there's great stuff about that. And I think it's because I want to like it, but I just have other stuff in my hierarchy of values. I think that's why I'm having this sort of emotional
reaction. Yeah, I don't think you should
feel
guilty about not playing this game, because it does take... I think what you've really come to terms with is that this game requires a deeper engagement than you're willing to put in for the pleasure that you get out of it, which is okay. It just, they didn't make this game for you necessarily,
which sucks because I'm like one of the biggest South Park fans on the planet. So I guess it kind of annoys me as much as I feel guilty about it, because it's like, I wish this game was made for me. You get what I'm saying?
You want South Park Bejeweled? Is that what I just heard?
Well, I have that. It's called South Park Phone Destroyer, and I play it on my phone, so I do have that already. But something that will be made for me, and before we get to the trailers, exciting news here, or not exciting, depending on the perspective you're going to take on this. According to The Hollywood Reporter, and I'm quoting here, Zach is back. Zack Snyder, who directed 2007's Justice League, only to step away from movies to deal with a family tragedy. Okay, editorial. Everything about that statement is incorrect. He directed an early cut that never saw the light of day, and his family tragedy was used as an excuse to fire him. All right, editorial complete. Back to the article. Has signed on to helm Army of the Dead, a zombie horror thriller for Netflix. Snyder will direct and produce with his new partner and wife, Deborah Snyder, via their newly rebranded production company, Stone Quarry. The Shingles Wesley Collar is also producing. Snyder also came up with the story for Army, which has a script by Joby Harold. The adventure is set amid a zombie outbreak in Las Vegas, during which a man assembles a group of mercenaries to take the ultimate gamble, venturing into the quarantine zone to pull off the greatest heist ever attempted. So, part of me is already seeing Daniel's reaction to this. I know that he is a Zack Snyder fan, but remember when we did the trailer for Hurricane Heist, and Daniel was like, this sounds stupid. Well, this is just zombie heist. Now, we know it's Zack Snyder, so there's going to be more depth to it. So, I'm excited for this. Netflix is giving him $90 million, and he's saying, quote, there are no handcuffs on me at all with this one. Saying that in the past, every movie he's made, he's been handcuffs with. And we've seen that with most of his movies have director's cuts, right?
Yeah.
Sucker Punch, which didn't even have the true ending he wanted. The director's cut didn't even have the ending he shot. It had a different ending than the theatrical cut, or different footage than the theatrical cut, but didn't have his ending. We know the problem with Batman versus Superman. We know people are still crying for the Justice League Snyder cut. So he's always had this issue with studios. So the idea of seeing full-fledged, full-on Snyder is very exciting. Now, on the other hand, people could be very cynical and say, does this mean the Fountainhead is never happening? So how do you feel about this?
I read the production company name again.
Stone Quarry.
The Fountainhead is happening.
So Stone Quarry, for the uninitiated midsiders, or those midsiders who have not read The Fountainhead, Stone Quarry is where Howard Rourke goes to escape the world when no one will pay him for his work. Correct, William?
Yeah, because everyone wants him to give up his artistic integrity in order to build buildings, and he decides he's only going to give them his physical labor. And so he goes and cuts stone in the Stone Quarry.
Right. And as Snyder, he released the whole logo and everything, and it says a sacred creative space that has been 4 years in the making. And interestingly, if you look at the logo, it's made to mirror, and I think it's meant to be a refutation of the hammer and sickle. What would you say?
I think so, too.
Yeah. So very interesting stuff coming out of the Snyder camp. Why do you think he's doing this one before The Fountainhead? Because someone gave him $90 million to make a movie?
I think so, yeah. He's just like in Fountainhead, he's getting money to do his artistic vision. So this is a perfect thing. Like, whether he does Fountainhead now or later, like, it's more like he has a story that he wants to tell and somebody's willing to pay for it, he's going to do it. I don't know that he has to do Fountainhead next. Where is it written that he has to do Fountainhead next?
Well, I think we all assumed he was going to do Fountainhead next because he said it was his next project. Yeah. And this is the other question. Do you think he's doing projects like this to make money so he can self-finance the Fountainhead because he thinks that's the only way it can get properly made?
That could be a possibility. Because it really could.
I think that's probably the ultimate argument is any movie of the Fountainhead will get ruined by a studio, so he has to do it himself.
Mm-hmm.
And we have seen artists moving in that direction. It was terrible, but what was the movie by the Fifth Element director, the big space movie? I can't remember the name right now.
I don't know.
The two people, I forget the name, but it was bad, but he self-financed that. M. Night self-financed Split and Glass to complete his artistic vision on his own terms. So we're starting to see these more individualistic, romantic directors go in that direction. So I think this is exciting. I will be watching it. I don't know if I'll be able to do the minute it's released on Netflix, but I'll watch it the day it's released. And we'll have another entry of the Snyder series coming up. So this is great. Army of the Dead. And I love that Zack Snyder loves zombies as horror villains, horror monsters, the same way I do. Because he has to love them because they represent collectivism, right?
I guess. I that's what I see in his films, the way he writes them and shoots them. So
right, so it's no surprise he would do a zombie thing. So very exciting. All right, let's round out this episode with some trailer takedown. As always, if you want to see the trailers, we have them on the midside.com/podcast. You can watch them before the episode. You can watch them after the episode. You can watch them during the episode. You can pause and you can listen to an analysis of one trailer, watch the next trailer, and keep alternating like that.
Trailer takedown. First trailer.
The Vast of Night is a retro trailer. This movie is set in the past, and it seems to be about people in a UFO sighting. This trailer was very well done to me because all they did was seemingly take a scene from the movie and use it as the trailer. And the scene was very well acted, and it was suspenseful, and it was a great tease. Is there a UFO? Is there not? I think from this minute and a half long scene that this movie looks tremendous. It looks right in my wheelhouse. William, it looks right in your wheelhouse.
Yeah, I was drawn right in. This is I have no idea anything about this movie or what the plot is about. But a trailer doesn't necessarily have to do those things, right? In this case, it set up a world which I'm interested in, which is a... For me, that's actually a better trailer for a sci-fi film. You don't want to give away any plot. You want to tease the world, draw people into that world. What is different about this world? Right now, I can see it's in the past, and I can see that there's some sort of unexplained phenomena going on, right? And it's done, and all of that was done without hardly any exposition, right? It was all done with action and visual. So
and
very interesting.
Tremendous acting it was done with. So thank you, Midsider Josh, for submitting this trailer via Discord. For me, this is a hug.
Hug.
Yeah, I think I already gave it away. I'm hugging this.
Hug. Second trailer.
Men in Black International is the sequel/reboot/whatever of the Men in Black franchise that nobody asked for. It stars Tessa Thompson, who played Valkyrie in Thor, alongside her Thor co-star, Chris Hemsworth, and also Liam Neeson. They're in the London branch of Men in Black, which... William, I guess we're kind of doing this non-linearly like we usually do. I want to ask you a question. I get the idea, like, in the past of, like, oh, hey, you know, we had a Men in Black office in New York and London and in Tokyo, in Beijing, in Sydney. Like, I get that in the past. But in our globalized society, isn't it kind of ridiculous? And this is actually a part. Did you ever see Torchwood?
Yeah.
This is a problem I had with Torchwood, too, that Torchwood was based in Cardiff. It made no fucking sense. In our globalist society, why would Men in Black need to have different offices throughout the world?
Seems like such a dumb question, but I'll attempt to answer. It's because the world is a globe, and it's round, and it operates on different time zones, and so you want people to have their natural sleep rhythm coincide with where they're conducting their business.
All right, that's a good answer. You know what? That is an acceptable
answer. That's one good
answer.
No, second good answer. You have to travel to get to places, and you'd rather be in London than
You're
Cardiff.
You're telling me the Men in Black do not have teleportation technology? They time travel than Men in Black 3. They
I'm just saying.
They can't teleport immediately from Cardiff or from London.
Why do they have
North
a flying
America
car
North?
Then?
I don't know. None of this makes any sense, okay? All right. So, okay. I accept that we can have NCIS... Beijing one day, okay? I accept that. All of that is fine, okay? This I can get past that part of the premise. So fine. So for some reason, they decided to put it in London. There is still nothing else interesting to me about this trailer. This really reminded me of the hollowness of the all-female Ghostbusters reboot. And what was interesting to me is I didn't get a lot of the social justice feeling from the trailer, but if you read the comments... People are responding to it in that same way, anti-social justice, where they think this is just being made to push the black female here, Tessa Thompson. Did you get that impression from this trailer?
Maybe a hint, but I think more I got that this is just candy, it's a skin, like a facade of Men in Black. It, just like you were talking about the Ghostbusters reboot. It's just we have these visuals in you know, 3D Studio Max or Maya or something. Like, we have these renders already from the last movie, from Men in Black 3 or whatever the last one was. And so now we're just going to put this in, you know, just going to paste these assets in and have all these guys, like, just stand in front of a blue screen. We're just going to crank out a movie.
Right. It's like, we can save money on marketing, too, because the namesake is already there. And that's what's sad about this, is the original Men in Black is legitimately a great sci-fi and legitimately a great comedy movie.
Yeah.
If you look at Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones, it's some of the best work of their careers. Vincent D'Onofrio, some of the best work of his career. Rip Torn, amazing in that movie. I mean, even Michael Jackson had a great cameo. And then this is what it's become? This is a tackle for me.
Tackle.
Yeah, I love good sci-fi. I'm thirsty for good sci-fi, but I can't watch the first trailer and then hug this one. Tackle.
Tackle.
Final trailer.
The Professor and the Madman is the origin story of the dictionary. That is completely serious, Midsiders. I'm not making that up. We've seen a string of these trailers now where we've had, like, the origin stories of, like, Mary Shelley and other such artists. Now they are doing it for the dictionary. It stars Mel Gibson and Sean Penn, and in it, and this is a quote, they develop a friendship that is beyond definition. I swear to fucking God to you, if I didn't know this was a serious trailer, I would have thought this was a parody. If they didn't have these big ass stars in it, I would have thought this was like a College Humor parody trailer. This is so absurd to me. The idea of trying to dramatize making the dictionary, it seems like it's romantic too, right? Like, in that it even has the line in it, like, oh, you know, if we don't give every individual a chance, blah, blah, blah. This is what happens when you take romanticism and you give it to people who aren't romantic. This is just, I can't say anything positive about this trailer, besides if you want a good laugh, watch it. Tackle.
Tackle.
I can't believe that the biopic film has turned into this sort of thing. This, like, this weird facade of romanticism and dramatization around something that would be probably make a great documentary, right? Or historical reenactment sort of documentary, right? Where they act some of the key points and something. This would be a really good documentary.
Well, that was that was something Daniel talked about, right? That seems to be he said there was a show on Netflix that was doing it. And it seems to be that's where they're going. There's a direction of mixing documentary with romanticism. And that seems to be a new sort of movie making that will exist in the future. And this would seem to be a perfect opportunity for that.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm going to tackle this. Looks terrible. Tackle.
Tackle.
All right, that brings an end to our episode. Let's put a bow on things so we can start getting ready for the Super Bowl. Also, my nose is running really badly right now, and I don't know why, and it's been distracting me all episode, so I really want to go take care of that.
It's been distracting me, too, since the snot is on my side.
Yeah, I'm sorry. So. I'm not doing it on purpose. I don't know what is going on.
I think he's turning into a zombie. The nose running is the first symptom, and then
I'm going to die right before kickoff is what's going to happen here.
Your sacrifice will help Brady win.
I kind of might be okay with that. What did you learn this trip, William?
Well, I learned that I can surprise Justin with a tranny story in the middle of the news.
Isn't that how you always surprise straight white people with trans? This should be the crying game edition.
Justin, what did you learn this week?
I learned that I have a surprising amount of guilt and anger about South Park the Fractured Butthole, and I may have to talk to my therapist about this.
I think so, too. Well, if you learned something this week, let us know. Give us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast app, Apple iTunes. You can also visit our website at themidside.com/podcast, where you can check out some cool stuff, buy some merch from our store. What else we got going on? Make sure you tell a friend about the podcast and share it on Facebook, Twitter, Gab, all sorts of things. Get the word out. And then make sure you check out our Patreon on themidside.com/Patreon and our Discord channel. Don't forget that. You can join, especially today. Well, it's going to be too late to join about the Super Bowl live. But we'll be consoling or congratulating Justin on Monday when this show comes out. So make sure you take a look at that.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Emelinesky reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a Patriots Day.